hard as I preached Sunday when I said cause is irrelevant. Lest men go through. It's so hard to figure out if God's doing anything. Like Carlisle, God may be in heaven, but what the hell are you doing? To be governed by God is to be constantly disturbed, to have human arrangements interfered with. Here is a man whom God has called to some definite piece of work, and in the place of his service, he is conscious of the divine presence, the divine blessing. It may be that after a period of toil and travail, everything is coming into adjustment, and the golden radiance of harvest is on all the field, and victory is at the threshold. Then suddenly to the soul of that man comes the voice of God, "Ye have dwelt long enough in this mountain. The work must be left, the location changed, and all the experience of the past apparently contradicted." The man is disturbed, and that by the divine government. Or in other ways, God disturbs us. Crosses the threshold of the home of peace and quietness and breaks it up. And we are no longer in the place of peace as we were. Because God has disturbed our lives. Really hard to believe everything, but you have to. And these lessons from God. I've taught it, the steps of a good man are ordered of the Lord. I read it last night in Paul's condition in Rome. God disturbs us, crosses the threshold of the home of peace and quietness and breaks it up. And we are no longer in the place of peace as we were. Because God has disturbed our lives. Some close earthly friendship or relationship in which comrade ministered to comrade in all things high and noble, sweet and strong, is suddenly broken in upon, and friends are separated as far as the poles geographically. This was written in 19:6-16. They're not my words. These are G. Campbell Morgan's. God is disturbing two lives. Hopes and aspirations that gleamed and inspired are suddenly put out. And all the movement of the years towards the goal seems to end in defeat. These are the common experiences of the saints. They are the problems of the saints. They are the problems of the men who observe the saints. Again and again they've been made the reason of ridicule of the saints. Along the avenue of these experiences, Satan is ridden with all his host to assault the faith of the believer. If God loved you, would he allow you to be thus disturbed? If God really loved you, would he not have left you that sacred, holy companionship? If God were really governing your life, would he move you while your work seems to be successful? God's always doing it. Divinely governed souls are always sojourners in tents. Pilgrims. The Bible says, "Let your loins be girded about and your lamps burning, and be yourselves like unto men looking for their Lord." That was the word of the Master himself, indicating to the men who would follow him that their true attitude should ever be that of expecting disturbance and change and alteration. Beneath the height of God's mount, we are encamped. impressed by its majesty and its glory, comforted by the great words of law which proceed from the heart of grace for the conditioning of our lives, seeing the mosaic of the divine arrangement manifest in constitution and ritual and beauty and in order, surely now at last, the long bondage over, we're finding a place of peace and quietness, when lo, suddenly the word is spoken. Break camp. Pack the baggage. You have dwelt long enough in this mountain. If the divine government of human lives be a disturbing element, in the second place, it's a progressive element. Why were these people disturbed? I go back to the actual text, and I will now read a little more than the text. The Lord our God spake unto us in Horeb, saying, ye have dwelt long enough in this mountain. Turn you and take your journey, and go to the hill country of the Amorites, and unto all the places nigh thereunto, in the Arabah, in the hill country, and in the lowland, and in the south, and by the seashore, the land of the Canaanites and Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Behold, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give unto them and to their seed after them. That reading of the context seems to make a defense of the disturbing almost unnecessary so far as this story is concerned. For thereby the light of the divine purpose flashes on the fact of the divine disturbance. And we see in that record the purpose of the disturbance was to get them on to the possession of the land. The place of silent solitude is to be left, and the way of the wilderness is to be trodden. But why? That the land which lies beyond may be possessed. God's the governor. He called us for a purpose. It's as I said Sunday. This Christian walk is a journey. There's no resting place. The place of silent solitude is to be left, and the way of the wilderness is to be trodden. Why? That the land which lies beyond may be possessed. Progress is not necessarily pleasant. When Moses described the journey a little later in this same discourse, he speaks of it thus. The first journey, remember, not the subsequent journey of discipline. Quote, Moses speaking, we went through all that great and terrible wilderness. Here again, the picture is a parable and the teaching is patent. God's dealings with a man today are always in the interest of perfecting his tomorrow. God's dealings with a man today are always in the interest of his perfecting tomorrow. Why can't God be satisfied with the progress we've all made? Why can't he just now let us, having been perfected, take this message to the world and let them start where we were? And when they catch us, then maybe a little more progress. We're sitting pretty. The whole world out there is listening to us. We must be perfect, or God wouldn't have given us this voice. All we got to do now is just pay the bill and talk. Tell everybody else to get on with being perfected. Can't do both. Does God have any sense? What's he doing disturbing us? We just want to be the voice of disturbance. We don't want to be disturbed. Here again, the picture is a parable and the teaching is patent. God's dealings with a man today are always in the interest of his perfecting tomorrow. God's disturbance of human life is always in order that the life may climb to a higher height and come to a fuller realization. I'm 65. Gonna be 66 this August. I'm high enough. Old enough. Perfect enough. God, work on some of you youngsters. God never listens to me until I'm agreeing with him. Not once have I ever changed his mind. So don't any of you young whippersnappers think you can do it. I got 40 years of arguing with him too. Now let all my exposition end as I take you to another of these discourses. Yet hardly a discourse, the great song Moses was commanded to write, and listen to it. The Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in the waste, howling wilderness, and compassed him about. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. As an eagle that stirreth up her nest, that fluttereth over her young, he spread abroad his wings, he took them, he bare them on his pinions. In that exquisite figure, we have the merging of the elements of disturbance and progress. And I want to deal with that figure after the station break, so get on telephone. No more calls. Reading from G. Campbell Morgan's Westminster Pulpit, his message on the God-governed life. A text in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 1:6. The Lord our God spake unto us in Horeb, saying, you've dwelt long enough in this mountain. But in that discourse that Moses gave, he also talked of God's care of his chosen people. In these words, the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. We belong to God. He found him in a desert land and in the waste, howling wilderness. And that's where he finds all of us. He compassed him about. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. Then this. As an eagle that stirreth up her nest, that fluttereth over her young, he spread abroad his wings. He took them. He bare them on his pinions. In that exquisite figure, we have the merging of the elements of disturbance and progress. It's a very Eastern picture. We in England, that's where he was preaching, can hardly understand this picture of the eagle. Even in Scotland, it can hardly be appreciated. We must get right away to the East if we would interpret its suggestiveness. Let us go and see what is happening. Yonder is an eagle's brood on the rocky ledge far up the heights. There the eagle has built her nest. There she has brought her young into being by her maternal brooding. And there she feeds them and guards them. The eaglets are in their nest on that rocky ledge to which none can climb and to which none can descend. They're in perfect safety. And the eagle watches over her young and broods over them. Let's imagine that we're living somewhere in the neighborhood and have watched the process from day to day until there comes a day when something happens that's full of surprise. The mother bird, another one of those mother images of God, the mother bird that has seemed to be so tender and careful is doing the strangest of things. She's flinging those eaglets out of the nest. Herself turning them out, beating them out. You're already ahead of him, aren't you? As I watch, I see the eaglets in the air, struggling, falling in the element which is strange to them. Eaglets must have strong hearts. Struggling, falling in the element which is strange to them, all the peace and safety and the restfulness of the nest is gone. As an eagle stirreth up her nest. Yes. You and I that feel in a free fall and see nothing but rocks below. Thanks be to God. The eagle spreads her broad pinions over the birds as they fall, and then suddenly with the swiftness of the lightning swoops beneath them and catches them on her broad wings. It seemed as though they must be destroyed. They are not destroyed. She bears them back on her wings to the ledge. What did Moses say? As an eagle that stirreth up her nest, that fluttereth over her young, he spread abroad his wings, he took them, he bare them on his pinions. The eagle bears them back on her wings to the ledge, and with a great sense of relief, the eaglets struggle back into the nest. They are so glad to be back. Tomorrow she'll do it again. And the next day she'll do it again. Until one day as I watch, I notice that one of the eaglets, perhaps a little stronger than the rest, when flung out of the nest and beginning to fall, puts out its wings and tries to use them. Then the purpose of the disturbance is seen. They will go on from day to day until one day those eaglets will not struggle in the air, will not fall, but will spread their wings and fly with the mother bird sunward. As an eagle that stirreth up her nest, that fluttereth over her young. So the Lord disturbs with progressive disturbance in order to realize life and all its fulfillment. I ain't no eaglet. I get tired of flying. And when you're surrounded by buzzards, it's hard to soar like an eagle. nests look nice to old birds, too. But so the Lord disturbs with progressive disturbance in order to realize life in all its fulfillment. Leave the eaglet undisturbed in the nest on the rocky height, and it will fail of the very powers that are resident within it. Fling it out into the unaccustomed air. Show it how to use its wings, catch it in its falling, bear it back again, give it a rest, disturb it again, and it will fulfill the meaning of its own life. Ye have dwelt long enough in this mountain. Leave that sphere of work which you love so well. Be severed from that comrade without whom you feel you cannot live. Know the breakup of home. What is God doing with you? Developing the powers of your own life, enabling you to discover the things in you which are of Himself, bearing you on His pinions in the moment of your utterest weakness, until presently He teaches you to use the wings He's given you, a disturbing element, but a progressive element. Finally, this government of God is a methodical element in human life. The provision is made, behold, I have set the land before you. The course is marked out. Notice how particular are the instructions. Take your map of Palestine and mark the country out. You will discover that these people never reach their destination, nor have they yet. God's limit was beyond anything they ever arrived at. Never. Did they stretch the bounds of their habitation as far as the great river Euphrates? I have read that to show that God had a plan for them which was possible for Him to express in terms of geography. But there is something else in this chapter I want you to notice. Quoting again Moses, "Thy God bear thee as a man doth bear his son, on all the way that ye went until ye came unto this place. Yet in this thing ye did not believe the Lord your God, who went before you in the way to seek you out a place to pitch your tents in fire by night to show you by what way ye should go, and in the cloud by day." There are things in the Bible I would to God I knew how to read as they ought to be read. Oh, the poetry there is in that. There is no poetry in the way I read it. Read it for yourselves and find the poetry. God went before you in the way to seek you out a place in which to pitch your tents. We sing today, and the sentiment is true and beautiful. Quote, "We nightly pitch our moving tent a day's march nearer home." End quote. Then let us remember that the pitching of the tent at night is not accidental. For God has been there before us. He's the God of the forefront, as I have taught myself and you. He gets on the corner before we get there. Think of it. I arrive nowhere but that God has been ahead of me. It may be that for the moment most of this congregation will be only reverently patient. But there is some man here in 1906, 1916, 1995. some woman, some youth, some maiden, buffeted, broken, perplexed, lonely, almost mad with the agony of life. Just where you are, God was ahead of you. Out of the terror of the hour, God help us to believe it. Out of the terror of the hour, He is creating forces of triumph in your life, which would always have been missing had you not pitched your tent right there where He has appointed the place. God is not making any experiments with you. There are some texts that we of a weaker generation hardly dare preach about. I'll tell you one. You'll find it in Samuel in the last psalm that David wrote ere he died. Quote, an everlasting covenant ordered in all things and sure. Yes, you say, that's all very well for David, but read more. And you'll find that David was describing what God's king ought to be, and he said, verily, my house is not so with God. Knowing his failures, David said, verily, my house is not so with God. Yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things, and sure. For it is all my salvation and all my desire, although he maketh it not to grow. When David sang of the covenant ordered in all things and sure, he sang out of his disappointment, out of his sense that he had failed. He saw even his failure as within the divine government. In his great letter to the Ephesians, Paul reminds us in infinite music that we are his workmanship. And not merely that we are his workmanship, literally, in the Greek, as I've told you, were his poem, but that we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God afore prepared that we should walk in them. To the man who is truly God-governed, the morning breaks, and there is in his heart the consciousness that nothing can merely happen in the infidel sense of the word. There can be no accident. Yes, I may suffer. I may suffer some physical evil, some mental trouble, some assault on the soul. I may pass through the great and terrible wilderness, but the covenant, His promises, His calling, His plan is ordered in all things and sure. God cannot be surprised. Contingency, exigency, are very useful words for you and for me, but God has no need of them. No exigency surprises Him. No contingency baffles Him. He sees the end from the beginning, and all the affairs of the universe are under His control. The man God-governed is a man who lives at the very heart of method and order. What, then, is our true relationship to this government? The answer is the simplest of all answers. Our true relation to the government of God is that of obedience, immediate, and unconditional. What are the conditions of such obedience? Confidence in the method, because it's a method of God. Even when I cannot see its value, keeping forever in view the ultimate purpose in me and through me, and being forever ready to be disturbed. I love the paradoxes of faith. Here's one. The only man who is never disturbed is the man who's always ready to be disturbed. Let your loins be girded about and your lamps burning, ready to be disturbed. Then when the call comes, you'll not be disturbed. It is when I allow my life to be anchored to friend, to home, to this or that. That if God wants me to do without this friend, break up this home, leave this or that, I am disturbed. Got the wrong anchor point. When my life is anchored in God, then no disturbance can disturb. That is the philosophy of life of the men who really live in divine government. Oh, the unutterable folly of doing what these people did. They started well, they struck their tents, they came to the borderland. Then they appointed a commission to find out about the land God told them to possess. That commission published two reports, the majority and minority reports, and then, as ever since, the minority was right. The people halted with fear. They went back. Then they presumed and tried to go in without God and fought the Amalekites and were defeated. Then followed 40 years of discipline. 40 years, God said, I was grieved with this generation. Consider in the light of this history what God does with people with whom He is grieved. He bears them as a man bears his son, with infinite patience and tender compassion, waiting for them. Someone has heard the disturbing call of God, it may be within the last 4 and 20 hours. If so, I think this sermon is for you. What are you going to do? Go forward? Counting no cost in your obedience? There are giants there. Yes, for you to slay. There are walled cities there. Yes, for you to take. There are rough ways ahead. Tramp them. They lead to peace. But there is awful loneliness. Welcome it. It admits you to more comradeship with God. The only thing we must not do if God says we've tarried long enough is to tarry. Some of you have heard that voice long ago and you disobeyed and you've had a long, weary wilderness. But tonight, you are once again on the margin of the land, and I pray you remember that all the wilderness has been in His government. This is the method of our God. He ever gives men a second time, the second time on the margin of the land. The word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time. If the vessel be marred in the hand of the potter, he will make it again a second time. All the years of the cankerworm hath eaten, he will restore them. He's plenteous in mercy and compassion. For the love of God is broader than the measures of man's mind. And the heart of the Eternal is most wonderfully kind. Some man listening to me quite reverently says, I do not understand all this. I never hear a voice like that disturbing me. No. You are living in Egypt, in bondage. Garlic, leeks, flesh pots. God forsaken men are not disturbed. Yet listen, God is calling even you, and at this moment some of you have heard Him asking you to readjust your lives from this moment to make them kingdoms of God. You've tarried long enough in Egypt too. At God's call, arise and follow, and He will perfect that which concerneth you. If you've been helped, get on the telephone.